We're recording now.
All right, welcome everyone. We're just going to give it another minute for folks to join. We'll get going here. Okay, welcome everyone to this evening's workshop, Who Does Mapping Serve? GIS and Environmental Justice and Climate Change Research Organizing in Action. My name is Chris Kennedy and I'm the Assistant Director here at the Urban Systems Lab at the New School. And I'll be helping to facilitate this evening's session along with several members of the lab and also the Tishman Environment and Design Center. The event is being co-organized by the Tishman Center, which is a hub for climate and environmental justice research and practice at the New School. So just a special thanks to Mike Carrington, Anna Yulzman, Anna Baptista for all their help in and their input in making this evening's workshop possible. So I'll introduce everybody in just a moment, but first I wanted to give you a breakdown of what we hope to accomplish over the next few hours. So we can go to the next slide. So first, we aim to explore critical approaches to First, we hope to explore critical approaches to GIS or geographical information systems, specifically asking a key question: who does mapping serve? As we'll discuss later, mapping is a complex social, political, and cultural practice that often does not include the diversity of voices and insights needed to be equitable. Second, we'll introduce some popular geospatial technologies, tools, and applications that may be useful for you and your work. And finally, we hope to build future collaborations on environmental and justice and mapping efforts here in New York City and around the globe. And just a quick note on this evening's session. This is by no means meant to be comprehensive or touch on all the issues related to critical mapping and environmental justice. But secondly, while our work here at the lab does not embody all the principles of critical and collaborative GIS, we are a highly skilled group looking to be more useful to community groups working on these issues and to learn about the needs of the larger community. So we hope this is a starting point for some continued collaborations, additional resources, and future gatherings, which we'll discuss later on. Okay, so what do we hope to accomplish tonight? Let me just provide a quick agenda. In part one, we'll provide some overview of concepts related to mapping and GIS. Part two, a brief overview of mapping in the context of environmental and climate justice. And in part three, we'll discuss GIS tools, example applications, and share some case studies from the Urban Systems Lab as well as the Tishman Center. And finally, in part four, we'll have a chance to break out into rooms for some discussions and talk about next steps. So with that, I want to introduce this evening's facilitators and speakers and tell you a little bit more about the Urban Systems Lab. Founded in 2015, the USL, as we like to call it, is an interdisciplinary research design and practice space at the New School that provides new insight in developing more equitable, resilient, sustainable cities. And we bring together designers, urban ecologists, scientists, researchers, and policymakers with the goal of developing systemic solutions to social and environmental challenges driving inequity and injustice in urban areas. So we have a number of resources up on our website, as well as a newsletter that I encourage you to join. And this is part of the Tishman Center's Climate Week set of events. So I recommend checking out their website for upcoming events happening throughout the week. All right, we can move to the next slide. So from the USL, we're going to hear from Claudia Tomateo, Veronica Olavata, Zee Grabowski, Pablo Jerez-Cantis, Ahmed Mustafa, and from the Tishman Center, Mike Harrington and Annie Yulspin. And just a quick note that might be of interest, we currently have a call for submissions out for a new quarterly publication we're calling Resilience. For our inaugural issue, we're inviting submissions from designers, scientists, students, artists, exploring the future of cities in the era of COVID-19. So you can check out our website to get some more information, and we'd love to hear from you. All right. And then just a quick note on housekeeping. We just ask that you please mute your device. And encourage you to use the Zoom chat to post any questions. We're going to be keeping track of those throughout the session today. We're also going to be using a virtual whiteboard called Padlet during the breakout session. So I'll share the link as that comes up, and that'll be a space for further recording folks' thoughts and further questions. And we also hope to post the video, or intend to post a video and a script that will be available for folks on the Urban Systems Lab website. And we'll send a follow-up email with all that information as well. And finally, I just want to take a moment to make a land acknowledgement. So we want to collectively acknowledge here that the New School University occupies the ancestral, traditional, and contemporary lands of the Lenni Lenape people. We honor the Lenape and other indigenous caretakers of these lands and waters, the elders who lived before, the indigenous today, and the generations to come. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Veronica to start us off with some concepts of mapping in part one.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Chris. Welcome everyone to this workshop. In part one, concepts of mapping, we will examine the following. We will look at different ways of mapping. We will provide a brief history of mapping, and we'll examine some of the conceptual issues characterizing the mapping process. Now, before we do this, I would like to invite you all to pull out the Zoom chat and write down the first words that come to your mind when you see the image shown on the next slide. So you see them here. Please feel free to put in some words. And the question is, what is each image representing to you? Don't be shy. Okay, great. So we have a boxing ring, image A again across. Somebody saying, Wendy is saying different ways of mapping. Great. B, somebody saying, Christopher is saying flooding. Eliza is saying New York. Great. Excellent. Somebody's saying A, Pacific Islander people's navigation maps. Great. Okay, so you're all coming up with incredible and very accurate definitions and descriptions. And this is amazing. Yes, so we're revealing now what these images are about. Yes, so some of you correctly got that the first image, image A, was an example of a Polynesian navigational map known as Meadows or Matangs, made of bamboo slats and cowrie shells. Image B, some of you, yes, correctly got that this is the Federal Emergency Management Agency special flood hazard layer for New York City, showing the insurance rates maps. Then C was, I'm not sure if anybody got C. Somebody said maps of transportation. Yes, partly. Yes, it's part of these are New York City zoning and land use maps. And D, did anyone get D? D, Basquiat. Someone said Basquiat. serial, not Basquiat, but so these were subjective maps of Manhattan from the book by Becky Cooper called Mapping Manhattan. So great, thank you all for your insights. Well, this was an exercise to sort of show that a map describes and communicates social, economical, physical, political, but also mental geographies in different ways. And that they can also serve different functions, like they can provide orientation, they can identify flood risk areas, they can identify land uses, and illustrate people's perceptions of space. So even if made relative through standardized units of measurements, like we saw in the examples of the FEMA map or the New York City land use maps, all maps, just like all models, are representations. They are cultural texts representing the wider social, cultural, technological, and political milieu of our society. Next slide, please. Next slide, thank you. So this chart shows how through time, general reference maps, which are simple maps of man-made and natural features in an area, have evolved on the basis of changing needs and ideologies. But also, next slide, based on technological advancements. So if general reference maps were mostly made manually, it is with the Industrial Revolution and mechanization that the reproduction of maps becomes possible. And today, as a legacy of electronic technology, some of us are making maps as digital files saved in our computers or online on clouds, and we're using digital digitally available data. Next slide. But really, it is with colonial exploration by European hunters, colonists, and missionaries that we see changing ideals, needs, and technologies leading to different cartographic understandings of the world. And the world seen as a globe, seen from above rather than a sphere within which we are embedded. And this idea also led to an abstract understanding of the earth as something that needed to be controlled, often by ways of erasure of indigenous beliefs, bodies, and cosmovisions that were not aligning with Western modern thought and scientific measurement. Next slide. Now, next slide, please. Cartography played a big role in sedimenting racist beliefs. So in the latter half of the 19th century, we see the measurement of racial traits or phrenology becoming increasingly dominant in physical anthropology, while at the same time, environmental determinism, or the belief that physical factors such as landforms, climate, determine the pattern of human culture and societal development, give way to what's called anthropometric cartography. So here we have a map by Yale and Harvard professor Ellsworth Huntington, who purported to demonstrate the correlation between, in the map at the top, regions of so-called climatic efficiency, with very high climatic efficiency shown in darker colors, and at the bottom, regions of general progress, the most civilized regions represented in the darker colors. So maps like these supported the productivity myth that a stimulating climate drove the development of a superior racial character and the advancement of civilization. Now, Ellsworth was a fantasist with little peer support, yet maps like these and the folk science, his folk science writings went on to influence the American Eugenics Society, of which he became them a board member. Next slide. Now, despite this history, indigenous cartographies, and here we bring back the Polynesian state charts, and as we will hear later from Z, not only persists, but shows sophisticated understandings of waves, islands positioning, and currents without the aid of any compass or mechanical devices. Mapping is always a social practice and displays this tension between standardization and specificity, but also how indigenous technologies particularly are process-oriented rather than product-dependent. Mapping is thus a multifaceted exercise in representing the human experience. As such, it is always plural and always subject to interpretation. Next slide, please. So to circle back to my initial statements, the map is not the territory, but a model of the territory, and as such, is cognitive, embodied, and culturally inscribed. And the questions that we raise in this workshop and in general mappers should ask, who are maps made for and for what purpose? So in the next slide, we explore a bit more this tension between the set and the digital space, people, plants, and minerals through mapping and forms of resistance to this form of social control. And I'll pass it on to Z.
So hey, all, as we sort of touched on in the preceding slides, I think, you know, mapping has a very strong colonial history and relationship with forms of domination. And as anyone who's ever had to interact with sort of DOD, there is a very persistent philosophy that, you know, the management of territory is not about simply identifying vulnerability. It is about mapping territory so it can be dominated. And this is a practice, a longstanding practice, that in particular in the United States, you know, it can be represented through this map here, commissioned by George Washington himself, which was a map of Virginia and beyond, which, as one of the original sort of aspects of Washington's practices and legacy and the tools that gave him political and economic power was his role as a land surveyor that essentially laid claim to indigenous land on paper and then built military capacity through both the British Army, Navy, and then later the so-called Revolutionary and Continental Army to physically possess that land through ongoing contested forms of conflict. So the precursors to the modern U.S. Geological Survey were also founded in this period when George Washington commissioned the Office of the Geographer to the Continental Army. And so these roots of the relationship between sort of claiming land and the establishment of speculative value and its tied to militarism and white supremacy, we could argue are perhaps impossible to separate from legacies of mapping. However, on this next slide, we can see that these claims in the contemporary period are actually quite complicated and quite complex in the sense that, as sort of exemplified here, the way that you can represent the never ceded and never surrendered territory, little known territory of Cunayala on the north coast, the Caribbean coast of so-called Panama, which was an autonomous indigenous zone that was never surrendered to the Panamanian government, despite ongoing military aggressions from the United States Navy in collaboration with that government. And in this case, the superior embodied knowledge of coastal reef territories allowed this group to defeat the US Navy in total war and essentially never cede their territory. However, when you look up this place, it is represented on Google Earth as part of Panama. So these spatial representations of territory are also inherently problematic, and we must always kind of question this, you know, on one hand, the sort of hegemonic dominance of mapping as an exercise, as well as the way that zones of resistance and liberation are represented in current digital cartographies. In the next slide, you can see that these are actual matters of very sort of practical and pragmatic significance, even in settler colonial states like the one we're all inhabiting now, where we have a representational form of democracy that, in essence, is supposed to guarantee equal representation to all members of the state, all citizens of the state, but in practice uses maps through the practice of gerrymandering, which is a bipartisan effort of reapportioning representational districts based on a knowledge of how those voters are likely to behave. So in this sense, gerrymandering serves as uses mapping as a tool to guarantee political power to parties through identifying the spaces in which those who participate in the electoral system inhabit. And even though this practice is widely seen as illegal, and this case in the suburbs of Philadelphia was successfully challenged in the Supreme Court and led to new procedural safeguards to prevent gerrymandering, As we can see in examples in other states, including North Carolina, this practice is ongoing and continuously contested. In this next slide, I want to switch gears a little bit and kind of acknowledge that throughout this presentation and throughout most discussions of mapping, we tend to privilege the visual sense. As someone with a deafblind child and who has friends in the deafblind community, though, I think it's very important to push back on the sense of all maps being visual artifacts. In this sense, there are many maps that are tactile, they can be felt, and also there are maps that can be represented through touch on the body itself. In this sense, the body is not just a container, but a way of embodying space as well as other subjective phenomena, as you can see here. This is a map of a very different form, where participants in an online survey are basically asked to self-report the relationship between emotions, including the sensory experiences of common ailments, and locate them on their bodies. And you can see that through, the responses from many participants, we can essentially create a heat map of where subjective experiences of self and sensory experience and subjective emotions can be referred to on the body itself. And so it's always important to remember that mapping is an embodied practice, even if we attempt to, represent one form of subjective experience, be it of a visual sense or an abstracted visual sense on paper, it's still an embodied practice. To wrap all this up, this last slide, we have some takeaways here to try to deliver on our promise of bringing together some conceptual cohesion around mapping. And we just want to kind of make it clear that A, mapping is always flexible. There's a persistent tension between the ability to generalize and abstract around space and representing specific phenomena, be they geographic or subjective phenomena. And that while technology can enable many forms of mapping and visual and embodied or physical representation, it is not necessarily superior to other forms of knowledge. It's simply a different way of representing space. And again, to go full circle, these many faceted uses of maps, while they are often tools for sort of oppression, social control, as well documented in numerous literatures, they're also key sites of resistance and tools to fight regimes of injustice. So thanks for sticking with us for part one, and I'll hand it back to take us to part two.
Thanks so much, Z. So in part two, we're going to be discussing mapping in the context of environmental and climate justice. So to give us a quick overview of that, I'm going to turn it over to Veronica one more time.
Thank you, Chris. I hope my connection will hold on. So in part two, we will examine the concept of environmental justice and climate change, and how climate change can exacerbate existing environmental injustices, how mapping and community organizing can expose distributional injustices, and what are the other dimensions of justice. Next slide. Now, environmental justice in the USA has a long history, and contemporary usage of the term environmental justice arose from resistance movements organized to expose the socially unequal environmental risks and effects of industrialization. Now, for decades, the environmental justice movement, various movements made of diverse coalitions of Black and brown people, faith-based organizations, researchers, have addressed the connection between race, ethnicity, and proximity to toxic facilities in cities. A 2015 survey of registered environmental justice organizations revealed that such organizations have become more diverse in mission and focus, including now land use planning, climate and food justice, energy poverty into their priorities, and calling for intersectional approaches between geography, sociology, medicine, and reproductive health. Next slide, please. Um, We are increasingly seeing how climate change is impacting more severely communities whose health, finances, properties, jobs have historically or still today been affected by disproportionate amounts of air, soil, and water pollution. This image exemplifies the connection between environmental justice and, sorry, can we go back to the one before? Sorry, Pablo, thank you. It exemplifies the connection between environmental justice and climate change impacts. It shows a fire that exploded in a chemical plant in Louisiana after Hurricane Laura this year, releasing chlorine gas into the air. Now, the plant is just miles away from remnants of Mossville in Louisiana, which is an unincorporated African-American community, which was historically encroached by refineries and chemical operations. Next slide, please. So this is exactly what Eddie Bautista, the executive director of the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance, defines as frontline communities, communities where climate vulnerability intersects with historical patterns of environmental burdens that disproportionately affect low-income communities and communities of color. So how is it that maps can be useful for changing these processes of neglect? Now, in this slide, we show how maps can be used to document environmental justice cases. This is one of the first studies to suggest that environmental racism existed in Los Angeles. It was done by the United Church of Christ in 1987. The map shows that out of 57 waste sites, 35 or 61% were located in zip codes that were at least 50% Latino, Latinx. Now, this map is an example of how one could use mapping to expose distributional injustices. While this kind of research on siting of industrial pollution is well-meaning, it can often, though, reinforce racist stereotypes if the overarching narrative about why certain communities face disproportionate risks are reinforced, which is what some geographers called conflating race with place. Now, understanding the why requires that we go beyond distributive understandings of justice. And in order to do so, next slide, we could look at the work of community-based environmental research, justice research, which is situated in the context of local circumstances and local knowledge. And it often uses mapping as a way of critiquing traditional risk assessments by exposing outcomes of racist social processes. For instance, here I show an example of the work done by WEACT, a grassroots organization based in West Harlem, and other environmental justice groups in Brooklyn and Manhattan, who have transformed their activism around environmental justice and clean air into research programs that emphasize community empowerment in study design and data collection, using the principles of speaking for ourselves. WEACT has developed the position that communities of colors and are not objects of study, but rather must be active collaborators with researchers and institutions to assess and eliminate the cause of poor health. In a specific image to the right, this was part of the Northern Manhattan Community Climate Action Plan, which was a 6 months long participatory planning effort to protect the most vulnerable populations by promoting environmental policies that also address longstanding socioeconomic inequality. Next slide. As I sort of introduced before, in environmental justice and climate research, we can map the social spatial distribution of harms across social groups. These could include toxic facilities, pollutants, but also extreme heat and flooding. Now, this is an example of a study where a comparison between populations living within and outside the flood zone in Houston, Texas, to the left, and Miami, Florida, to the right. And here, sort of the results show that in Houston, Hispanic immigrants have the greatest likelihood and non-Hispanic whites the least likelihood of residing in a flood zone. In Miami, on the contrary, it was revealed that non-Hispanic whites have a significantly greater likelihood of residing in a flood zone when compared to Hispanic migrants. Now, this points to the complexity of how coastal development occurs and the contrasting role that water-based amenities can play in different cities and the importance of these issues for distributional justice. Next slide. We can also map in environmental justice research is the distribution instead of not just harms, but benefits from either environmental remediation programs or protective infrastructure to protect populations from the impacts of climate change. So for instance, the distribution of coastal adaptation projects and the possible job creation that may result from this. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, produced a set of guidelines for measuring the distribution of both harms and benefits due to shifts in agricultural yields, sea level rise, extreme weather caused by climate change. Next slide. What is normally not mapped as a spatially mapped in environmental justice and climate research are other different are two different types other two types of justice, recognitional justice and procedural justice. Recognitional justice asks questions of how our climate strategies or environmental strategies, visions, and policies addressing vulnerable groups, historical contexts, and structural racism, whilst procedural justice asks questions such as what are the processes of citizen engagement in climate and environmental planning? How accessible, diverse, and open are they? How has participation affected distributive outcomes? Next slide. And for this type of research, we really need different type of methods. In the first case, it is common to use critical discourse analysis, document text analysis, institutional ethnographies. And in the second case, in the case of procedural justice, methods such as surveys, oral histories, and interviews can be used. As I will show later, we can also use oral histories to enrich what data can tell us about the distribution of harms. Now, to conclude this section, some takeaway points. So I think the impacts of climate change add new burdens to communities of color, especially those living in already polluted environments. That community-based environmental justice research advocates for and with the needs and desires of communities, aiming to influence more just environmental and climate planning. And finally, that distributional justice research through maps can expose environmental and climate risks, vulnerabilities, and the distribution of benefits. But the other dimension of justice require different methods and approaches. I'll give it back to Chris for introducing part three. Thank you.
Great, thanks so much, Veronica. So we're just going to take a brief moment, a break here, just 1 minute to transition to this next part here. So I just want to encourage anybody that has questions, comments, anything that came up for you as you were listening to put that into the chat at this moment. And then we're going to transition into hearing a little bit from the lab members on case studies and some examples of this in action. Just to note too that we really are encouraging folks to use this as a networking opportunity. If you have a project, you want to need a map to be made, this could be an opportunity to meet somebody new. So just put any ideas you have into the chat and we'll have a chance in the breakout rooms to connect with folks. So whenever you're ready, I'm going to turn it over to Claudia Tomoteo, who is one of our designers and data visualization experts here in the lab. And she's gonna kind of lead us on into this next part, GIS tools and practices.
Thanks, Chris. If we can go to the next slide. So this is sort of the agenda for this part, which is focused on the tools and practices for GIS. We first have mapping as an analytical tool, the difference between mapping technologies, critical GIS as a method, and the pragmatic approaches for using maps to achieve positive social goals. We'll move forward. I would like to share with you this quote that for me as a designer always helps me to start thinking about maps and mapping. The map is at once empirically rooted and imaginatively liberated and liberating. So as Denis Kozorov phrases, maps in geographical and abstract space are empirical, meaning that they serve a practical purpose, but also that they have the capacity to produce new geographies, liberating both the knowledge and the individual. So cities get lost without narratives, and the liberation is precisely their vision. Maps as design and political tools provide us with the means to understand not only the physical features of a place, but its ethereal temporal aspects, populations, cycles, tensions, informing and empowering design and bridging the many disciplines that operate in the built and unbuilt environment. So in the next slide, we can see sort of the structure of what I'm going to explain here, which is ways of conceptualized space in maps and mapping techniques and operations that can serve the construction of these spaces. It's important to note that neither of these categories are mutually exclusive, and actually a map can hold different spaces and different techniques. So to start with, I'm going to explain this brief conceptualization of space that David Harvey uses to divide space in absolute, relative, and relational. So for instance, the absolute space is a space that represents reality in a fixed and measurable way. So we can see here the footprint of a flooding event, the south of Manhattan. About relative space, it is a spatial frame that depends upon what is being relativized and by whom. These are circles that represent combined sewage outflow. And of course, the circles don't exist in reality. So what does it mean? The circles represent flows. It's an abstraction of the data to explain relationships. And then finally, we have the relational space, which are processes that occur and define their own spatial frames. Objects exist only in the relationship with one another. This means that we forget about the geographical space and we start mapping relationships and how they create their own space. This means that, for example, environmental justice doesn't have to always be geographical, but it can be about relationships and how we construct these relationships. So moving forward, this is sort of the part for techniques, that what we call mapping operations. So this is just provocations to start thinking how we can represent space, whether it's absolute, relative, or relational, according to the narratives that we want to provide. So we have the drift as an idea borrowed from the Situationist group of artists, activists during the 50s and 60s that aimed to disrupt any form to be the dominant regime for capitalist power. Maps that reflect subjective street-level desires and perceptions rather than the totality of the city's fabric. This is a relational map, for example. A form of cognitive mapping, drift is capable of showing new topographies, re-territorializing the ground. And then we have this very interesting quote by James Corners that says, if mapping had been traditionally assigned to be colonizing agency of survey control, the Situationists were attempting to return the map to an everyday life and to the unexplored, repressed topographies of the city. So this is for an example of a map resisting its abstract space experience. Then we have layering in the next slide. Which is a pretty straightforward concept, and many of us use this as a resource, which is basically the superimposition of several independent layers to thicken a surface. And through layering, we can analyze and synthesize data because of new relationships that appear when interacting and informing each other. in so creating a new complex and rich fabric open to an infinite number of interpretations. This is, for instance, a map that is tracking solar radiation and at the same time social interactions used around the city to see if there is a relationship about temperatures and the use of the city, for instance. Later, we have the game board operation, where it's basically a surface that is managing different objects and their relationships and sort of facilitate relationships. So the game board is a sharing working surface upon which various competing constituencies are invited to meet to work out their differences. The map in this case plays a role of facilitating moving pieces, finding a common ground, able to play different scenarios, test relationships and situations, setting up the game board to instigate. Layering and drift can be also developed within this technique, within this operation. And here I would like to strengthen a point that Z mentioned earlier about the tactile maps, and that maps are not only digital or like a piece of paper, right? We have here an example of the Sahuita rock in Cusco, where it's basically a mapping device for landscape. This is not necessarily representing elements in absolute space, but it's representing relationships between elements in the landscape. And then on the right image, we have more of like a conventional way of using the game board, where you have different elements that are managing different data sets at the same time, but they are starting to build relationships and calling each other out. And in the last mapping operation category that we have is the rhizome, which is very, I'll say it's very related. It's almost the same as the relational space. It's starting to think about open-ended and indeterminate characteristics. The rhizome connects any point with any other point. There's no beginning and no end, no hierarchical, and continually expanding. Allows a plurality of readings, uses, and effects. It's inclusive and structured. It has inclusive and structuring qualities. It allows flexible representations, and it's a synthetic composite. So in this way, a map does not always represent a space in a single matter. They can always change, and we can see that, for instance, in interactive platforms, where we can go from very geographical representations to representations such as this example, which is a globe of economic complexity, where you can basically click on one point and see, and each point represents a resource or industrial production from a country. And then when you click on it, it starts tracking out their global economic interactions. It's very interesting. I invite you all to play around with it. So to finalize my part, if we go to the next slide, I'd like to start to think about how maps have evolved and historically how they started to be manual, but they always have worked within this sort of classification of conceptualizations of space, whether it's absolute, relative, or relational. In the first example, we have this map by Charles Piquet, where he created a map-based representation of cholera outbreak in Paris. And we can see how the colors are relative to the concentration of cases, right? And on the right, we can see how this famous map by John Snow, how to start tracking by this stacking of lines, cases of cholera, and then it was actually the map that was able to map the source of the problem. But so how we evolve from this, and how we can learn from this, and what are the new technologies that we can use? And here I would like to invite Ahmed to sort of explain to us the tools that we use in the lab, and how we can use them.
Well, thank you for that. Just a second. I think I lost control over. Okay, we got it. Sorry, go on.
Okay, so thanks for that, Claudia. So in the next few slides, we are going to focus on mapping software and data that we commonly use in Urban Systems Lab, as well as examples of cases. Next, please. So actually the GIS software that we are often using in the Urban Systems Labs are ArcGIS, QGIS, and IDRISI, all are GIS software that allow for creating, storing, managing, and analyzing spatial data. ArcGIS is one of the most powerful GIS software. It provides several tools for processing various geographic data, performing geoprocessing analysis like buffer analysis and selection by location and so on. However, ArcGIS is a proprietary software managing, meaning that we can only purchase a license that grants the right to only use the software. Another software which is highly comparable to ArcGIS is QGIS. QGIS is a free and open source software that grants users the right to use, study the code, and even change the core code of the program. And of course, it's free to use. So we mean here by free is a freedom. So we are free to reshare the software, to change the code and so on. QGIS can perform most of GIS functions. Also has a huge online community for providing support and advancing the software over time. However, ArcGIS still has more advanced topological analysis and mapping production tools. Next, please. Also, we are using IDRISI. IDRISI is another GIS software we are using in the lab. It provides many tools for classifying and geoprocessing imagery and raster data. It has also built-in models for spatial land use change and other spatial statistics tools, including PCA, principal component analysis, and logistic regression. However, comparing to ArcGIS and QGIS, IDRISI has poorer vector geoprocessing functions and mapping production and rendering tools. Next, please. So here, an example showing how network analysis in QGIS can help identify areas without access to green spaces within 400 walk distance. So the areas actually in dark red. Next, please. We also use several libraries and packages in R, Python, MATLAB, spatial and non-spatial actually. And those tools are very flexible and open to user creativity. And of course, various of spatial modeling tools related to land use change, flooding, and local climate, such as to measure local climate, such as surface air temperature and wind. Next, please. We also use other generate software to help us in producing high quality maps and graphs, as Adobe Illustrator, Photoshop, and other tools for creating dynamic online surveys, such as Quartex, and content analysis and document analysis tools, such as Atlas TI. Next, please. And regarding the data in our daily work, we often use multiple data sets related to census in order to examine or study various socioeconomic settings of different communities. We use meteorological data such as temperature, precipitation. We use some topology and geographical data such as elevation, land cover, and also some urban infrastructure, green infrastructure, street, foods, and building footprints, and of course, some city plans such as zoning plans, and real-time remote sensing data coming from open source platforms. Next, please. Open source platforms such as NASA and Google Earth Engine, which provide access to multiple resources of satellite imagery and geospatial data sets, both historical and current. including climate-focused data sets that can be used as a critical indicator for tracking climate change, for example, tracking sea and inland water surface levels and temperature, tracking air quality over time using Sentinel data sets from Google Earth Engine, for example. I would like to move now to Veronica again. So Veronica is going to talk about critical GIS as a method and as a social process.
Thank you. Thanks, Ahmed. Yes, so if we think of GIS as a tool, we believe that, especially in the case of community-based environmental justice research, GIS should be thought of a method and as a social process that actually goes beyond just participation. And there's many scholars in this field that I've had a lot to say about this issue and have analyzed GIS as a critical tool. Here I have a quote by Fatima Kohli and others at Barnard College, who defined critical GIS as a way to utilize mapping as evidence to render visible inequities otherwise rendered invisible. And this is because it offers a framework of inquiry that can interrogate space in ways that traditional GIS cannot grapple with. Next slide. The way in which this is done is really by thinking of GIS as a social process. So to think through reflexive questions, and how do we organize the participatory arena in a participatory GIS mapping process? So in this case, we should ask ourselves whose desire and subjectivities are present in the participatory process, and how are safe spaces created and nurtured. Next slide. We should also be thinking about how matters of concern are articulated. So here I have a list of things such as openness and structure. So how diverse are the groups represented? How are their different identities allowed to express themselves? In terms of accessibility, we should think about how earlier people engaged in the process and are location and time of meetings acceptable? In terms of language, we should think about, is the use of technical jargon minimized or clarified? Are materials and events proposed in different languages? In terms of technology, we should think about who decides what methods are used to collect data and who can use mapping technology and data. And finally, in terms of the scale of the problem, we should think about the unit of analysis and how using data from either county, district levels may confound attempts to prove patterns of discrimination. Next slide. So also we should think about how can we map within a long-term plan or strategy for transforming outcomes that are unjust at present. And so how can a map aid in achieving such desired outcomes, or how instead could it hurt the communities it is supposed to serve? Next slide. And finally, if we are evaluating the effectiveness of the participatory mapping process, we should think of how do we follow through? So who defines and who participates in the assessment of project outcomes? What kind of research return are there? Who benefits from the work? And finally, how do we keep building the relationship that was created and what keeps this engagement going? Next slide. Here, I'd like to give a shout out to a project that I had the opportunity to see at the excellent Mapping Injustices conference that organized at Fordham University last year here in New York City. And it asks exactly these reflexive questions I just mentioned, and it is a collaborative participatory GIS project between students at Barnard College at Columbia University, undergraduate students, and the Mississippi Low Income Child Care Initiative. And it was born out of the Mississippi Low Income Child Care Initiative, need to understand economic insecurity of Mississippi women, and it is sought to do so by moving beyond current understandings of poverty. It used interviews with women to refine an economic insecurity index, determine weights of the index through questionnaires and surveys with community and childcare experts, and most importantly, it mapped women's poverty disaggregated by gender and race, and it enriched it with oral histories as a way to unflatten county-level aggregated data. Next slide. We point to other projects, mapping projects that we think are incredible in this respect, that use critical GIS and are made of, for instance, by nonprofit organizations or by citizens, such as the North Brooklyn neighbors who are currently monitoring local air pollution through purple air sensors. So these are some of the examples that we wanted to point at. Of course, there's many more. I wanted to pass it on to Ahmed for the final part of the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Veronica. So now I want to share with you some case studies from Urban Systems Lab and Dishman. But first, please feel free to place any questions you have about these GIS tools and resources in the chat, and please share any platforms or tools you are commonly used in your daily work. So back to showcase examples, I would like to start with modeling urban change, and then we'll give the floor to Pablo to continue with other interesting showcase examples. So actually we have our own special land use change model. And land use change models are tools to support the analysis and causes, analysis of the causes and consequences of land use dynamics, land use and land cover, of course. Also, they can serve as scenario-based tools, which is important to support land use planning and the policy to evaluate the purpose of the land use plans. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, we developed our own land use change model, but some softwares such as Breezy included land use modeling as a module in the software, and there's a bunch of open source and free to use land use models like Dynamica, for example. And then I would like, in the next few slides, Pablo will continue with some other very interesting showcase examples.
Thank you, Ahmed. Well, before I go on, just want to say, as everybody else has already iterated, that I'm super happy to see so many people today and see some of you folks being so active in the chat. Please keep the questions and the remarks coming. I know that maybe we're not addressing all of them right now, but I really hope that later in the breakout session that we're planning to have, we will be able to open up the conversation much more and hear from you folks. So yeah, thank you for being such a wonderful crowd, even from the distance. So yeah, I'm just gonna show a couple of projects that I have participated in as part of the Urban Systems Lab. And the first thing that I wanted to show is this animation of our New York City data visualization platform, where we have uploaded potential environmental justice areas for the entire New York State. This was a rather simple project that basically consisted on using the same criteria used by the New York State to map potential environmental justice areas according to the census from 2000, but using 2010 data. However, you know, one of the things that we value most about that project that was just the beginning of many other projects that use this data as a background was that by adding it to our data visualization platform, we are aiming to not only showcase our work, but also make it available for anybody who might be interested in using this data or at least visualizing it. So I encourage you folks, if you're interested, to click to go to that link and see what we're trying to build in that database platform. And you know, if you might have any questions about the data that we have or any requests, feel free to contact us. I hope that we probably can cover you with some of our data. And a very illustrative study of how my work at the USL has been linked to mapping environmental justice is this project that I did on mapping the distributional justice of ecosystem services in New York City. So while there is some work that links the distribution of socioeconomic groups and race and income to different to the distribution of natural land cover, such as parks or street trees, in this study, what we were trying to do was relate the distribution of people to the distribution of the benefits that green infrastructure in the city of New York may provide to its population. So what you see on the left is a map of hotspots and cold spots of areas where there is a higher mismatch or a higher difference between the amount of benefits that nature provides and the actual need or urgency to reduce certain risks that are related to urban resiliency and urban climate change. So in this case, for example, we're seeing in what parts of the city there's a higher risk and a lower supply of ecosystem services related to the mitigation of local temperature due to urban heat island. And making some statistical analysis after we make this map, we're able to determine that there's actually a much higher presence of low-income communities or communities of color in those areas that are served worse, that have like higher heats, higher risks due to extreme heat, and at the same time, lower presence of vegetation. Another very recent work that we've been developing, I'm seriously apologize for all this COVID talk because I know that we are all hearing about COVID every single day of our lives, has been to relate, you know, this same as in the previous slide, relating the distribution of the impacts of COVID-19 across not only different socioeconomic groups, but also its overlap with environmental justice issues, such as the distribution or the accessibility to green spaces, especially considering that green spaces in the last months have been such a critical asset for so many of us that have only been able to be outside of our homes by going to a park. So in this study, we've related the distribution of COVID hotspots and cold spots in blue and red on the left map to the distribution of accessibility to green spaces. And now I just wanna hand it over to our partner C, who has already spoken, to illustrate how we have gone a bit deeper with this study to relate the distribution of COVID-19 vulnerability and its impacts with how it relates to housing precarity, which I found extremely fascinating. So why don't you go on, Z, and we see what you gotta say.
So yeah, just a quick example that also illustrates that even though spatial patterns and maps might not be readily visible, they are also useful tools to kind of just represent the phenomenon visually and then do supporting statistical analysis underneath it. So in this case, we use data from the ANHD on cumulative housing displacement of renters across New York City by zip code, which you can see in the panel on the left, from 2017 to the present. And we used the other data from the Department of Health on the percent of the population that has been confirmed with COVID-19. And we found that even though the spatial patterns are sort of visually weakly correlated, when you correlate them statistically, that is the most significant relationship we could find of any other social indicators of vulnerability. So to us, this is saying that the same communities that are at the greatest risk of being evicted are those who have the largest sort of structural and systemic pressures to be exposed to COVID-19. So again, we wrote up a Medium post on this. It's part of a larger push to push for policies around just recovery and tie them to a just transition. But it's just one example where, you know, we can use different lines of evidence to push for, you know, progressive social policies using maps. But I believe we now have another example from our friends at TEDC here.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me. My name is Anna, and I'm a program coordinator at the Tishman Center. And I guess just to start, I wanted to mention that at the Tishman Center, we don't do any of our own research. So we're always invited in by EJ organizations to help them produce research that they are already working on, or will co-produce a project together. And almost always we're providing evidence and data for what people on the ground already know and are aware of. So that it can be used to advance environmental justice policy or as a tool for, you know, general activism and advocacy. So as an example, right now we're working with two EJ scholars and activists to do an equity analysis of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. And as part of this research, we produced these maps that show power plants, REGI qualifying power plants in New Jersey and their coincidence in EJ communities, as well as PM2.5 emissions. So as you can see, the majority of these power plants are located in EJ communities, and the largest emitters are also located in EJ communities. And then on the right, we have a map that shows EJ screen respiratory risk, as well as the REGI power plants. And again, you sort of see this correlation between the highest respiratory risk and power plants that are located in EJ communities. And these are not published yet, so keep an eye out on the Tishman Center website when they are, but hopefully, you know, these maps can be used to target emissions reductions standards for the power plants that are in EJ communities and really sort of like target those facilities for policy change. And I guess I just wanted to say that, you know, as a center located at an academic institution, we really think critically about how we engage with community. And the Tishman Center is sort of dedicated to shifting resources from the new school to EJ communities. And we do this in part by providing, you know, technical support to frontline grassroots community organizations. And sort of in line with the founding principles of environmental justice, the Jemez principles, instead of assuming what people need and want, we really let people speak for themselves and aim to amplify sort of the knowledge and expertise in EJ communities, relationship building and building trust as we go. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Anna. So just to wrap up a few points from this third part, we've got some key ideas here to share with you. So first, maps can have different conceptualizations of space and various techniques, right, exist to analyze these spaces. Secondly, access to and knowledge of GIS software and data is an increasingly crucial component in map making. And so we're gonna actually share out some of our data sources and some of the free resources that we commonly use or have access to. Three, critical GIS uses tools within a larger social process of articulating concerns, designing strategies to use maps to achieve desired outcomes, and evaluate the overall process. And finally, these processes themselves are fraught, right? And require ongoing humility of scholars and sustained engagement, right? And keep asking that question, who does mapping serve? Great. All right, so now this is the opportunity for us to connect a little more intimately. In the next 20 minutes or so, we're gonna break out into 6 rooms, which is each of the presenters will be inside of. And so what we'd like you to do is to take a moment to look at the Padlet that we created, a whiteboard that has some questions that we could use as a starting point for conversation. So you can use the QR codes here on the side, or we're gonna paste the link to the Padlet into the chat. And so just some questions to consider, you know, how do you think mapping and JS can contribute to different kinds of injustices we see today, right? How can mapping and JS be used to address these crises, right? What are some of the solutions you're seeing out there? We wanna know if you're working on a fun project or you need help, right? What are some possibilities for collaboration? And what was the most surprising thing for you today, right? What did you learn and take away from this this session today? And I'll just note too that we're really keen on getting folks together in the future. So we're gonna circulate a sign-up sheet. If you're interested in continuing the conversation, we'd love to host another gathering that's a little more informal, just to talk about how we can work together further. So we're just gonna collect everybody's information and we'll send out details for a kind of an interest meeting that we'll plan in the next month or so. So everybody's going to be randomized and put into these breakout sessions, and we'll spend about 20 minutes discussing, and then we'll come back to the larger group to wrap things up for this evening. All right, I think we're good, Mike. We can go into our breakout rooms. Okay, Mike's just setting that up. Welcome back, everyone. Let's give everybody just a moment to reconvene here and we'll wrap up. Okay, well, thanks everybody for sticking around and sharing your evening with us. I hope you had a really good discussion in our breakout groups. We just wanted to wrap up tonight by sharing any just like kind of key ideas or points that came up in each room and also just an invitation to continue the conversation. So we'd love to hear from you if you're interested in staying involved and like to meet up again. You can sign up for just use the sign up sheet here that I'll put in the chat. Just see if you have an email and a name, just let us know if you want to be involved and we'll shoot you some resources and also an invitation to join another gathering similar to this, maybe a little bit more informal. But I just want to hear from all of the presenters if there was anything interesting that came up in your breakout group that you might want to share to the larger group. Anybody want to kick us off? Claudia, what came up in your group?
Sure, I think we had many interesting conversations, mostly related on the challenges for GIS and for data. We talked some about, for example, informal settlements and how to map them and how to deal with places that are challenging to get data from, right? And sometimes you have to build your own data. And then questioning where the data comes from, and then acknowledging, I think one of the main key points for our session was like acknowledging that GIS is just a tool, you know, it's not the solution for all the problems, it's biased as well, it can be good, it can be bad. So sort of like looking this with critical eyes, and not be afraid to mix other media, right? Or hand drawings, archival images, videos, interviews, audio, to sort of like grasp it from our own disciplines and what our capacities are and use, I think Jonathan said, and he wrote very nicely about it in the Padlet that, it's good, but it can be very detrimental. And then we always have to question where data and software, even if it's like open source software or not, right?
Yeah.
I think it was very nurturing.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Claudia. What about you, Pablo? Anything come up that was like of interest or?
We eventually ran out of time and it ended up feeling like a very short conversation. Just because of the lack of time. But I think I have like three key points that were raised briefly. First, well, there were a lot of mappers in my group, at least a couple of them. So there was a first point that was brought up was the importance, you know, to be transparent and to be comprehensive when presenting your results to a community. It was, as an example, it was given, you know, like the maps that have been presented here in our case studies that are the result of very complex scientific research methods that were presented, you know, in like 20 to 30 seconds per slide. So there was not that much time, you know, to give a context of like, you know, what we mean by park when we're talking about parks access or how are we actually mapping ecosystem services. And of course, in the context of this workshop, it it might have made sense to be so brief, but when you're presenting this to a community, there's also a responsibility to consider in how are you giving the information and how can you be, you know, able to represent the caveats of your own methods. Also, of course, ideally, you know, and I think that was another point brought up by Karim, to like, maybe those caveats or methods don't have to be the result of the assumption made by me, the researcher, but maybe they could be, you know, the decisions made by the local community in making their own maps and asking their own questions instead of like a desk office worker. And then finally, you know, by the end, we also touched a little bit on what Claudia has said, you know, something that we maybe have not talked that much in this webinar is about the data, you know, and like maps beyond GIS, because when we think GIS, maybe we think about the slide of a PowerPoint or a PDF or a PNG, but you know, we are constantly being mapped with our data, and data belongs to people, and data is updated and organized in ways that have their own ethical issues. So I guess that might be an exciting future conversation about, you know, how to tackle that as part of what mapping actually means nowadays in this real-time society that we live in.
Thanks, Pablo. Anything from Z or Ahmed, anything to bring up before we wrap up?
I could briefly share that we had people who were definitely interested in learning more about mapping, though we also had some really interesting observations in terms of mapping as a tool to build solidarity between communities who are facing similar struggles, but may not be aware that they are, you know, facing similar struggles as other communities. And so that was an exciting idea of like mapping out those struggles as a way to kind of incite a more collective organization. As another exciting idea to me was the idea that you can use maps to make somewhat invisible institutional policy, political processes visible and salient to communities that are affected by them, but might otherwise not feel that they have like a way to participate or a way to push back on diverse things from FERC and like pipeline decisions to forest management to EPA decisions or to even things like building codes. So those are some things that came up. And if there was anything else that folks in my group thought was important, feel free to chime in. Those are the two things that really stuck out to me.
Okay, thanks to you.
And for my group, actually we have an interesting discussion about data. Yes, they were asking about data sources and also how data can be biased based on who is framing framing or the collection of the data and so on. And also we go over a greenmap.org platform, which provide kind of voluntary and mapping collection for almost 65 countries, which is very interesting platform. So yeah.
So good to see Wendy here. Green Maps, yes. Great. Yeah, my group, with similar things, we actually had somebody involved in the census on my group, and we talked about some of the challenges they're facing and just, you know, getting this process rolling. It's wrapping up this week. We talked about how we use the census so much in our work at the lab and how the 2020 census might not be necessarily the best reflection of the country at this moment. And just finding alternative ways to accurately and more equitably represent some of that data, which is pressing. So if you haven't participated in the census, make sure you do. And I do hope that you're registered to vote and will participate in upcoming elections. Great. Well, thanks so much, everybody.
Chris, I didn't report back.
Monica, yes. Hey, sorry.
Okay. Now, very quickly, I just wanted to talk about some of the, we discussed a lot about projects and interesting ideas that people in the breakout session were thinking of working on or are currently working on. Cyril shared her interest in mapping the history of neighborhoods in Brooklyn and to show how gentrification changed them. And so the anti-eviction project came to mind, but she's looking for connecting with with people who are thinking about doing the same. Also, Marcel has been working on mapping relationship between COVID and housing precarity in the tri-state area, and he's having issues about how to get about the unit of analysis. And so he's curiously knowing if there's a way to see if his correlations are holding up at the regional scale from the county level he's using. And interestingly, also Brandon is working on a project mapping land title deeds in Flushing, Queens, based on land deeds from the 17th and 18th century. So great projects. I hope you guys, everybody has left their email so we can get in touch with you.
Great. Thanks for having come. Thanks again to everyone for coming. Thanks to the Tishman Center. We'll hopefully see you in the Matrix soon. All right. Thanks, everyone. Have a great night.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good night. Bye.